Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here. Isn't it a beautiful day? Glorious day. We got the sun back. We're in the middle 50s already. You heard that. What's the predicted high today? Well, we just heard it. I was half listening. 61. I should be listening closely, shouldn't I? Huh?
It's just
high near 61. Low 60s today. Tomorrow, let's see, mid-60s. So we're looking really good, and let's get out and enjoy. I had to turn the furnace on. I finally chickened out, Kyle, overnight. I just couldn't take it. I was losing sleep because it was like 30-some degrees in the house. So, you know, it's too early. It's, what, September 13th, and I was, darn, my Scandinavian stubbornness was prevailing for a while, but I just finally had to cave in and turn on the old furnace. Boy, it felt good.
Yeah, when I got up this morning, it was probably, what is it, 7 o'clock that I got to my car, and there was just frost all over. I actually had to chip my windshield off.
I really don't want to hear that, but that's the truth, yes. Well, Stan Turner here. I should identify myself, and thank you very much for being on board here. You know about the show. You've been with us. You know, we're coming up on our 10th anniversary of this show. Started on Halloween, boo, back in 2004. So we're going to have a big party here. You know, can you imagine all the telegrams and goodies coming in here? I can't, but it's going to be fun. We want to market. We have had hundreds of guests over the years. Terrific people. They are what make this show go. So I'm so grateful to them. And by the way, speaking of which, it is time to get caught up on all those things that befuddle us, bedevil us, confuse us, frustrate us, occasionally delight us. We're talking about government and politics. Did I say delight us? Well, once in a while. One of the best explainers about all this is David Schultz. David is a professor of just about everything that matters at Hamline University in St. Paul. Politics, government, business, law. You have read his comments in the papers. You've heard him on the radio, see him on TV. He is one of those remarkable go-to guys when it comes to blowing away the dust and the fog and telling us what it all really means, what's really going on. Naturally, we are delighted that David Schultz is a regular on this program, and even our midday weekday all-request music show here on KLBB. Yep, David knows a ton about pop culture, music, too. But today, it's the top 40 news stories we're going to talk about. David Schultz, welcome back. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
It's always great to have you in the studio here. We've got lots to chew on today, David. Lots going on.
That's right. Politics at this time of year, there's plenty to chew on and plenty to think about.
There is, and even we're going to jump across the Atlantic Ocean and talk about Scotland in just a minute, too.
Right.
But first, I want to pay homage to a dear friend of mine who passed away this past week, and somebody you knew, too.
Yes, I did.
David Schultz. We're talking about Jack Young. What a guy. There's a word, a Yiddish word called mensch. Jack Young was a mensch, an upstanding person. Jack, his career included running two prisons in Minnesota and heading the Minnesota Corrections System. And this man believed in balance. He believed, and this is the words of his son, Grant, he believed that some people needed to be locked up and some people could be rehabilitated. Grant said he certainly was not a lock 'em up and throw away the key guy, nor was he let's let everybody loose kind of guy either. He did strike a balance. Jack, when he passed away this past week, was 87 years old. Jack Young served as warden of the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Stillwater from 1968 to 1971. And that, you might recall, was a time when prisons across the country were in turmoil. Yes, they were. There was a lot of movement for prisoner rights and so forth. So Jack came in at a very, very difficult time. But those who knew him well in the correction system said that Jack, and this is so true, was a man of integrity, and he understood what needed to be done to run a prison safely and successfully, to run it humanely as well. He was a true professional and a real gentleman. That's a consensus. Jack was a Republican. He resigned from the warden's post in 1971 after clashing with his boss, Commissioner David Fogel, who served under a Democratic administration. Wendy Anderson was governor then. Fogel tended to favor a more liberal approach to penal administration. Jack lived in the Stillwater Prison's warden house with his young family, and he was the last warden to live there. It's right down here at Stillwater Prison, right across the street from the prison. The house is now known as the Jack and Adele Young Conference Center. Adele is his wife. Grant Young, Jack's son, was in kindergarten when his family moved there in the warden's house right on the prison property. He has fond memories, Grant does, of playing with prison inmates who were sent over to mow the grass and to tend the flowers at the warden's house. Grant says, when I didn't have friends over, I was playing with convicted felons. Dad, he says, Dad always did an interview with them prior to them being allowed to work on the house to make sure that they were not violent offenders. Grant says, I played with car thieves and the money launderers, but not the people who hurt other people. Jack served as superintendent of St. Cloud Reformatory before he went to Stillwater as a warden there. St. Cloud Reformatory from 1963 to 68. And he said he liked being the boss of the prisons there. It was tough duty. Jack told me once that his son, Grant, I was just talking about him, he was the subject of an attempted kidnapping and ransom plot by one of the inmates at St. Cloud Reformatory. Jack told me one of the inmates up there tipped him off that there was a plan afoot to kidnap Grant and hold him for ransom. And the idea was to kill him if he didn't get the money. Well, they were tipped off, and the plot was foiled. Thank God for that. Jack Young was popular among the inmates at Stillwater Prison. This according to Bob Erickson, who was later a warden there. Everybody liked him, even the prisoners. He was a very personable guy, Erickson said. And I'm quoting widely here from Mary Devine's obituary, her great story that appeared in the Pioneer Press this past week. Thank you, Mary. Great job. Jack, according to Erickson, was not what people expected when they think about a prison warden. Anybody could walk right into his office and talk to him. He was not afraid to go into the prison and meet with the inmates and talk with them, and the inmates, appreciated that. Jack was known for his trademark flat top crew cut. Remember that?
I did.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of us had those.
Yeah, yeah. He walked around the prison in a white shirt and sleeves pushed up. He believed in being kind and helpful to inmates. Never talked down to them, according to Grant, his son. He treated everybody, whether it was secretary or an inmate or a maintenance engineer or the governor, with the same degree of respect. Now, this is where I met Jack Young. It was back, it's hard to believe, this time, this far ago, during an attempted prison break at Stillwater in the early 1970s, Jack Young negotiated face-to-face with armed prisoners and eventually secured their surrender and release of hostages. The cons had taken over a cell block or two in there, and they had shivs, they had weapons. Jack walked right in there. I know, I was out there. He had a cigar plugged into his mouth. He kept going in and out of the cell block. He showed no fear whatsoever. And this is a story Jack told me, and Mary Devine quotes this, and this is true. During this attempted breakout, Jack said, one of the inmates told me he was going to cut my head off and roll my head out the door. Young recalled this in an interview to me and others, but I told the con it would not roll. My head wouldn't roll because of my haircut, my flat-top haircut. That broke up the inmates who were, they absolutely broke into laughter and diffused the situation. But Jack said, there's only one way any of you are getting out of here, out of the cell block. It'll be in a body bag. And that was it. And he meant it, and they knew he meant it, and the whole turmoil came to an end. One of the inmates told me, a year later, Jack was stabbed in the hand and the chest by an inmate who was serving a 10-year sentence for aggravated robbery. He came right over the table. They had a little conference room. Jack had no idea what was about to happen, and he was badly injured, but he recovered from those injuries. What a guy. Well, I'll tell you what. I one final memory, David and everybody, about Jack Young. I had a little party at my place one summer. Jack and Adele were invited. We had a grand time, and Jack was absorbed in conversation, and he walked right through a sliding screen door that I had there. Well, it was easy to do.
Sure.
I wasn't drinking. This was just we were yakking.
We've all done things like that.
We have, and he went right through it and really tore the screen out of there. And he was profuse in his apology. He said, Jack, don't worry about it. And I got a note from Jack, tongue-in-cheek. He said, I have a couple of convicted felons who are going to come over this week and repair your screen for you. I said, Jack, no, thank you. I'll take care of it myself. What a great guy. Jack Young, fond memories. Thank you. Rest in peace, Jack. Those who served with Jack Young under him or served time under him, I know many of them hold, even the inmates I'm talking about, hold him in high regard. So there we are. Jack Young, one of the best public servants I can think of. Well, there we are, David Schultz.
Well, one of the hardest jobs in the world.
It's an impossible job. It's
of course
a no-win job.
Yeah, right.
But he went right into the teeth of the beast and did it. Unbelievable. Yeah, he had that compassion. Passion for the job and compassion for everybody involved. So there we are. Well, David Schultz, we have lots to talk about. You know, we'll talk about the domestic political situation, both here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and nationally. But let's jump across the Atlantic. Next Thursday, my goodness sakes, there is going to be a referendum in Scotland. Yes. And polls show that the Scots, I don't know, they are very closely divided on whether to withdraw from the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom being England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland.
Correct.
Right? So, and Scotland's been part of that since, for about 307 years.
Yes.
The polls are close. What do you think? What's going to happen? What's your guess?
Boy, if I could make that prediction, yeah. I would be playing the ponies at the racetrack.
You'd be winning big money.
I'd win big money. It's going to be very close, because if you looked at it about a month and a half ago, it didn't look like it was going to pass. And I've seen some polls now are suggesting that either it's neck and neck, or that the vote yes for independence is ahead at this point.
Wow.
And this has huge repercussions, of course, across a lot of different ways. First, the banks have said that if this were to happen, the Bank of Scotland has already said it's going to leave Scotland, yep, and go somewhere else.
Right.
It might also affect, clearly, David Cameron, who's the Prime Minister, mm-hmm, over there. Mm-hmm. If this is a vote yes, he's out of office. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. And then you have to think in terms of what impact this might have eventually upon, let's say, Wales or upon Northern Ireland, especially. Northern Ireland, I was talking with my students the other day, speculating and saying that that's going to have to create momentum at that point, yeah, for Northern, right, Ireland to want to reunite with the rest of Ireland. But this is pretty dramatic, because, this is the breakup of the United Kingdom, when you think about it.
Does the U.S. have any stake at all in this? Will we be affected, even long range, if Scotland pulls out?
Short term, no. Longer term, potentially, yes, in terms of the strength of Great Britain, in terms of one of our allies. Yeah. Perhaps it has some bearing in terms of maybe some military alliances. But I think in the short term, clearly no. Longer term, again, I think the bigger repercussions are for Europe and for the United Kingdom. Because, again, if Scotland leaves, how does this affect things such as the membership in NATO? Yeah. How does it affect things such as the European Union?
The pound, the British pound,
British pound.
That affects
United States
currencies all over.
Right. That's where I think it plays out. But I think the other implication for it is in terms of other places around the world. For example, Catalonia, which is where Barcelona is in Spain. They're going to be having a non-binding referendum in a couple of months, and they're looking to see what's going to happen with Scotland. And then there may very well be other independence movements around the world that too are also looking at what's happening in Scotland as a signal regarding whether or not they would also want to break up too.
Amazing here. Scotland derives a lot of revenue from offshore oil, oil drilling, right?
Yes, and I was going to say, during the Thatcher era, Great Britain was energy independent during the 1980s, mostly because of the oil that was off of Scotland. And so if Scotland goes independent, that dramatically takes away a lot of the oil from Great Britain, which then, of course, will change sort of the geopolitical situation with Great Britain, because right now it has been less dependent upon oil than has been some of the other European countries. And how does this change in terms of how they deal with, for example, Russia, or how they deal with Mideast politics? And so that may be, as we're thinking about it, that may be the bigger implication in terms of how Scottish independence affects United States in terms of how does it shift Great Britain's strategies in international affairs.
And don't forget, Britain parks its nuclear fleet and its nuclear armaments in Scottish waters.
Yes.
So, they're going to have to put border checks between England and Scotland.
They already have one. People don't know that. Yeah. Not a border check, but they have Hadrian's Wall.
It's been there a while.
It's been there since the Romans.
That's right.
But that's a good question. I'm assuming they won't have to put formal borders there, but we don't know what they're going to do.
The referendum is next Thursday, the 18th of September. Again, what's your guess? What's your gut at this point?
It's going to fail, but barely.
Yeah, that's my guess too.
It's going to be something like 50.
Yeah.
0.2 to like 49.8. What it reminds me of is back when they had all the votes in Quebec,
mm-hmm,
in France, Quebec in Canada,
right.
Where they got very close but never actually went independent. And I think you'll see that occur also. That's going to get incredibly close. That's why I could see it being about 49% for yes and about 51% no.
Well, they're breaking a sweat in London and Westminster. There's no doubt about that. They're throwing some bones, some sweeteners to Scotland. They're giving them more tax authority. Autonomy and all the rest. So they're clearly worried, and this is going to be good. But I would have to agree with you. It's going to be close, but I think Scotland will stay within the UK. cocaine.
Yes, right. Right.
That's our guess, folks. Our
that's right.
Uneducated guess. I don't know what we call that, but
what should we be doing? We should be surveying golfers and scotch drinkers right now in the United States and finding out what their thoughts are.
Pour me another one. There we go. David Schultz, Hamline University professor. Oh, here, we're going to shift to domestic politics and government, things going on that affect all of us. We're not turning this into a lecture. We're visiting. We're discussing things that affect all of us here, and we'll get to that after this break. Stay with us.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
Here is good news from the Valley Bookseller in Stillwater. The Saturday Storytime Trolley will continue through September. This event includes a ride on the trolley with an author or storyteller, and your $5 registration includes a token to board the trolley, a discount of 20% off a children's book that day, and a snack after the ride. The trolley picks you up at the store. You do need a reservation, so call Valley Bookseller, 651-430-3385, to reserve your spot and book the Saturday you want. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people in Stillwater.
99 Sonics are here on the ground. 99 Sonics are here.
Jenna.
You take one to town, drive it around.
Jenna.
98 Sonics are left on the ground. 98
Jenna.
Sonics. What, Tom?
Why are you singing?
Well, I'll tell you, Tommy boy, cue the music. The 2014 Sonic is here at Stillwater Motors. Now the 2014 Sonic is the only vehicle in its class that's built in America. And it's the only vehicle in its class to receive a 5-star overall safety score. Sonic also gets up to 40 miles per gallon, and if you want to see it, get down to Stillwater Motors.
Okay. This all sounds wonderful, but it's got to cost a fortune, right?
Wrong. It's only $13,190.
Get out of town.
I will in my Chevy Sonic. Give them a call at 651-439-4333. Just off Highway 36 in Stillwater. Right on the corner and right on the price. Find them online at stillwatermotors.com. Now sing with me, Tommy.
99 Sonics are here on the ground. 99 Sonics are here. Stillwater Motors. Good people to know.
We are back here, Stan Turner with you. Thank you very much for your company. Beautiful day, isn't it, out there? 12:23 right now, and what do we have? About 54 degrees, and we're going to be heading... What happened to my screen here? It just went blank. That's okay, just so my mind doesn't go blank. I guess I did something, Kyle. We'll fix that a little bit later. Looking for a high today in the low 60s, so very good thing going here, and we have a very good thing going here with David Schultz, professor at Hamline University, talking about politics, government, and not to bore you to death, quite au contraire. We're talking about issues, matters that matter to all of us, that affect all of our lives. We just talked about Scotland, that does not have an immediate impact on us. Let's move over here to things that do. Minnesota's governor race is ramping up here.
That's right.
I guess the Dayton, the Mark Dayton for governor campaign. Of course, he's the incumbent DFL governor. They're prepared to roll out about $1 million worth of ads here in the coming days.
Why they're doing it this week?
Why?
Because the 19th is an important date of September.
Really?
September 19th is 45 days before the election,
yeah.
Which means starting on Friday's the 19th. Is it Friday the 19th?
Yep. Friday the
19th. Friday 19th.
Yep.
You can go to the polls in Minnesota and start voting.
Early voting, right,
because 45 days out is when the absentee ballots get mailed to the military personnel,
right.
But also in the state of Minnesota, and people are forgetting this,
right.
Is that the legislature passed a law this past year that allows for no excuses early voting.
Right.
And so starting on the 19th, you can go to your local, not your local polling place where you vote, but your local, like city hall or county hall, something like that,
right.
And say, I want to vote. And at that point, you can start casting your vote. Now, for example, I live in Ramsey County.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Elections is on Plato Boulevard.
Right.
Go down there, tell them where you live and so forth like that, and they'll give you your ballot and you can vote. And so the reason why I say that is it's not a surprise that they're starting to roll out the big ads this week, because people are going to start now potentially to go to the ballots on the 19th. And so think about it as a challenge for a candidate
Good point.
Instead of having to use a running example, mm-hmm. peak at the end of the race. That is on November 4th this mm-hmm. year, whatever the mm-hmm. date is.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to start to roll to the votes over the next 45 days. Yep. And so what you want to do if you're a candidate is that you want to, I think, is it the 4th?
Yeah, I'm checking out the calendar
just
here
just
right
to be
now.
Sure.
It looks like the 4th. Yes.
It is the 4th. I got it right. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Got it.
So what's happening is that if you're a candidate, you want to get your supporters early voted as soon as possible, get them nailed down, sure. Get that money in the bank, at, you know, literally the voters in the mm-hmm. bank at this point, and then concentrate on other people. So again, no surprise that what you're going to see this week is the big hits to try to tell people get out to vote, but more importantly, both sides, in this case Dayton and Johnson, are going to try to convince voters that the other side is horrible and you better come out for me.
All right. And no longer, thanks to the new law, do we have to say, well, I'll be in Thule, Greenland
that's right.
on election day, so I better vote early. Now, you don't need an excuse.
Don't need an excuse. I early right. voted for the primary, right. and it's simple. You just show up and you just say you want to early vote, and I just had to tell them where I live to verify my address and so forth. They don't ask you a question about are you going to be sick, you're going to be out of the country, you're going to be winter birdies, or whatever
ballot.
Like that. Just give me your ballot, boom,
okay.
and that's
okay.
it.
Okay. Let's go down the line here. Mark Dayton versus Jeff Johnson. Dayton, the Democrat. Johnson, the Republican. Mark Dayton, to your mind, what are Dayton's strengths and what are his vulnerabilities right now?
His biggest strength probably is the fact that the state's economy is doing pretty well at this point. And for good or for bad, incumbents get credit for good economies, they get blamed for bad economies. Whether they have any control over it or not is a different story entirely. Mm-hmm. But what he's going to be able to say is that the economy is doing well. He's going to say that I raised taxes on the rich. He did that. He's going to say that I cut taxes for a lot of other people, which he sort of did. And he's going to say that he's increased spending on things like education. He actually has a pretty good narrative at this point. His weaknesses, though, I think one becomes the fact that I'm not sure how you play out the Viking Stadium at this point, because you've got the Viking Stadium with all kinds of problems, along with the Vikings with all kinds of
problems. Don't they have problems?
They do have problems.
Adrian Peterson being the latest.
Yeah, I was going to just mention, we were talking off the air before we started. Right. There's an interesting article in today's New York Times. This is a quick aside, and it goes back to the year 2000, and it looks at all the NFL teams, and which NFL team has the most arrests of any team? The Vikings. So we have to be changing our name from the Minnesota Vikings to the Minnesota Felons or something like that. But anyhow, I think that the whole Vikings funding becomes a vulnerable story at this point, and I think that's going to be the biggest one.
Really?
And I say that because while the Republicans are going to try to also use the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare against him and say, well, you know, Minshew is essentially that, and talk about how the rollout was not very successful in Minnesota. The fact of the matter is that there are a lot more people insured now than there were before. And the other issue they're going to try to use against him is the funding for the construction of the new Senate office building. Well, Dayton actually came out against that. So I actually think that the Republicans have a difficult narrative to convince voters to say that things may look like they're doing well in the state. Mm-hmm. But they're really not.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk then about Jeff Johnson, the Republican-endorsed candidate for governor. That's Dayton's main opponent.
Right.
His strengths, his weaknesses, or vulnerabilities?
Strength, I think, is the fact that he's a decent person. Anybody who's ever actually met him knows that Jeff Johnson is just a really nice guy. And in an era, and I think it's always been that way, where Americans especially want to sort of like their candidates, Jeff is a likable person. So I think he has that going for him. I think he also has the fact that he's looking like he's done a successful job since August in terms of uniting the Republican Party behind him. I think he also has an advantage in the sense that in a non-presidential election year, mm-hmm. voter turnout will be lower than in a presidential year, mm-hmm. and that generally favors Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I think he's got those going for him.
Okay.
In terms of his weaknesses, I think, again, I would describe it as, again, the narrative. How does he convince voters that things aren't going so well, and that he has a viable alternative?
Okay.
I think that's one. And I think his other vulnerability is the fact that the Republican Party still doesn't have a lot of money to support him at this point. And so he is a little bit more on his own in terms of trying to take on Dayton in terms of raising money.
The previous management of the state GOP party drove it into bankruptcy. They couldn't even pay their lease money. They almost got evicted from their state headquarters in St. Paul. So that, he's part of a party. He and the others are trying to clean up a huge mess.
Right. On May 31st, the Republican Party of Minnesota had $35,000 in the bank. At one point, the Democrats, I think, had about $300,000 or $400,000 in the state party. Mm-hmm. At one point, I think the Republican Party was over $2 million in debt. Mm-hmm. Again, the previous management, not the current management.
Previous
management, ran the party in the ground, right. And as audit pointed out, there were a lot of questionable spending and a lot of money that seemed to disappear. And so it was mismanaged and perhaps bordered on felonious.
All right, wow. David, we know that swing voters, independent voters, undecided voters play a critical role in electing candidates these days. Jeff Johnson picked up the endorsement of Tom Horner, who was the Independence Party candidate for governor 4 years ago.
Yeah, this is pretty significant.
And he, Horner, I think, had garnered about 12% of the vote. That's big.
He did have 12% of the vote last time, and this time the Independence Party, which I think is one of the other stories here, the Independence Party candidate for governor failed to get enough contributions to qualify to participate in the state public financing, and probably we're looking at this election, unless something unusual happens, the collapse of the Independence Party, because they may not get the 5% that they need to qualify to stay as a major party. Tom Horner, people forget, was always part of the Republican Party.
That's right.
And moved out of the Republican Party along with people like Governor Arne Carlson, mm-hmm. and Senator Dave Durenberger,
Jim Ramstad,
Republicans who were sort of solid moderates who really ran the state at one point and felt like they were pushed out by the current party. So Horner has moved back into the Republican Party, and again, for whatever weight he carries, that's important, because again, we've got about that 12% that went to the Independence Party candidate last time, which is Tom, which is in play right now, and will they go over to Jeff Johnson or not? Now, this is significant, I say, because I want to tell the story, because 4 years ago, I still remember on election night when he conceded, that is, Tom Horner conceded, he made a statement that said that he would love to still serve the state of Minnesota in some way. I thought the biggest mistake that Mark Dayton made after he took office is he should have given Tom Horner a job.
Mm.
I would have offered him a job and Tim Penny, who's also with the Independence Party, job.
Right.
And what would I have done? I would have brought that Independence Party into the Democratic Party and made a major coup in terms of pulling them over. He didn't do that, which I thought was a mistake, because now what we're looking at is that 12% is in play.
It is.
Will they go to the Democrats, Republicans, or will they stay home on election day?
And there are many who are not feeling good about Tom Horner leaving the party 4 years ago, because they feel he took away votes from Emmer and got Dayton elected, because remember how close that Emmer-Dayton
It was, but I got yet another story.
No.
That
David Schultz has another story.
That Tom Hauser, you know, who's at Channel 5.
Well, he was in my class at St.
I know. Tom Hauser and I did an interview about 2 weeks or 3 weeks after the election 4 years ago. And the most interesting statistic in there, it was like one of these like public policy poll ones, is, you know, so the election's already over, and they asked people who had voted for Tom Horner who was your second choice.
Okay.
And what was interesting is that about 39% said they would have voted for Dayton, about 27% for Emmer. And I did some calculations, and what that suggested with that breakdown is that had Horner not run, Dayton would have won by about 25,000 votes.
Wow.
And so actually,
that's an eye-opener.
Actually, Horner hurt Dayton.
Dayton.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah,
not Emmer.
Right, and almost nobody remembers that story. If Tom Hauser's listening, you remember the interview. I know you do.
He was one of my best students at St. Thomas University. He was in my class that I taught. What a wonderful guy.
He's a great guy.
He really is. Bright guy. So,
yes.
Tommy, good work, and thank you, David, for enlightening me. I learned a lot right there. I always do from you. Let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. Al Franken versus Michael McFadden. Franken, the Democratic incumbent. His strengths, his vulnerabilities.
Mike McFadden, we'll start with him, right?
Okay. Go ahead, sure.
We'll do it. We'll do McFadden. Okay. His strength is the fact that he has money. And one of the things that the other candidates didn't have was money. So he's got money. He's got a pretty good ad campaign he's using out there. He's trying to do a campaign that ties Al Franken to Barack Obama and to Obamacare. That's sort of be his strength at this point. In terms of his weakness at this point is that I'm not sure that that message of tying Frank into Obama and Obamacare works in the state of Minnesota. I think he's also working against the fact that even though it's a Senate race, that the economy still favors incumbents, even federal incumbents. And so I think that's an issue. In terms of his weakness, I think we're starting to see that being exploited right now by Franken in terms of, for example, the inversion of his company, you know, in terms of...
Let's talk about what we mean by inversion.
Inversion is what we saw with the story about Medtronic a few weeks ago, where Medtronic is buying a foreign company based in Ireland. It'll shift its headquarters over there for the purposes of...
It's a legal headquarters.
Legal headquarters, right. Mm-hmm. For the purposes of basically saving on taxes. And what they're doing is exploiting loopholes in American law to do this. Now, the company that McFadden has was bought by a larger company. The larger company is incorporated in Bermuda and therefore on paper, and therefore it saves literally hundreds of millions of dollars a year in terms of taxes. And so what Franken is doing is trying to tie McFadden to that. And with that, we also have the statement that McFadden had made. I can't remember how many weeks ago he was up on the Iron Range and he made a comment to the effect of, well, if it's cheaper to buy U.S. or to use Chinese steel than American steel, we should do that. Well, that doesn't exactly play
that
too
doesn't
well.
Play well on the range.
On the range. No, sure. And so I think a veiled statement really here is that what Frank is playing on is here's somebody who's out of touch with American workers, who's unpatriotic, and who just doesn't seem to care about the U.S. economy, much in the same way that the Democrats successfully used, what's the phrase, vulture capitalists against Mitt Romney in the last election. Yeah. When in fact, people have to remember that election 2 years ago, it was actually Newt Gingrich who invented that term to use against Mitt Romney.
Newt did.
That's right.
Interesting. Political ironies all over the place. We're talking with Hamline University Professor David Schultz here about the body politic, somebody. I've got to talk to you about Michelle McDonald, who is the Minnesota GOP endorsed candidate for state Supreme Court.
Yes.
What a mess this is for the GOP in this state. She is facing a DWI trial, yes, presumed innocent until proven guilty.
And resisting arrest.
And resisting arrest as well, and also violating terms of her limited driving privileges after that.
That's right.
And then she was showing the door recently at the Minnesota State Fair when she approached the booth of her own party, and there they were to say, get out of here, you're not welcome. Why doesn't the party unendorse her, David? Can they do that?
There's no reason why they can't.
Why haven't they?
I think because of the embarrassment of sort of having to backtrack at this point.
Well, isn't it embarrassing to continue with
it? It is. There's no question about it. I think they would rather have to just go bury this under the door or under the carpet and as opposed to something else, but as opposed to, I guess, trying to remove her at this point. And so I guess they're hoping
her to pull out.
She's not going to do it. And there was actually some stories about whether or not they're trying to force her off. And there are some state laws that make it illegal to offer somebody something of value to leave the ballot or to do certain things. It's a criminal bribery law.
Wicked, isn't it?
It is. And so the Republicans both would love to have a candidate for state Supreme Court. They would love for her to go away. They would love for her to walk away. But they can't really sort of do anything at this point. Now, what could happen, though, is that, again, her trial, I think, is what, this coming week, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. I think it's, what, the 15th? It starts on Monday. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. If she gets convicted, depending on what she's convicted for, that may make it easier for the Republicans to be able to extricate her from the ballot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to see what happens.
All right, okay, we will. David, I can't help but noticing as I drive around, we always see lawn signs for political candidates, legislature, all the rest. That's always been around. I'm seeing fewer, though, these days. But what's noteworthy is you never see any political affiliation anymore. Used to be GOP endorsed or DFL endorsed, Labor endorsed. You don't see that much anymore. What's going on?
I know, that's really interesting. Partly because they're appealing to the swing voters, because the base knows who's the Republican, who's the Democrat. The battleground in the state is for the undecided voter, and everybody wants to portray themselves as somebody who could be desirable to that swing voter, to that and usually it's a centrist voter too. And so they're not even talking about the issue of whether or not they're a Republican or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the state legislative level. Local races is a different story entirely, where those are in theory nonpartisan, races. But at the state legislative level, I was noticing it today too when I was driving on 95 coming in today.
Yes.
I was looking at all the row of signs out there for the state legislative candidate out here.
You never see a Republican endorse. You never see a deal.
I know. And I was reading it. I was trying to figure out and saying, okay, what party
who
are you
with?
That's right. But no, it's all about the fact that they're trying to capture that undecided middle and try to and not say which party they are.
It's the golden middle, apparently, that elects candidates.
Exactly. So, in any place where less than 50%, or any state, in any place where you don't have any party commanding a majority of the vote automatically, the battle's going to be for the swing voters.
David Schultz, let's take a break here. We'll come back. We have lots of things. Let's revisit that Viking Stadium financing business. And also, we'll get to Obama. His ISIS strategy, immigration policy, he's backtracked on that, all kinds of interesting things. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Valley Bookseller invites you to the store on Sunday, October the 12th at 2 p.m. for the In-Store Book Club. We will be discussing the classic Truman Capote book, In Cold Blood. Set in Kansas, the book is an accounting of the two young men who robbed and murdered a Kansas family. It was among Capote's first major novels. Join us on Sunday, October the 12th at 2 p.m. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. Located at 217 Main Street North in Stillwater.
Is your car living on borrowed time? Most of us overlook some of the most important regular services until it's too late.
This is Andy Lundstedt, owner of Certified Transmission and Total Car Care. For over a dozen years in Stillwater, we have built our reputation on exceptional customer service. That's why we can say Certified Transmission and Total Car Care, where our customers send their friends.
Certified Transmission and Total Car Care. Schedule an appointment at certifiedtransmission.biz.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
Another virus?
Relax. At Computer Repair and Services, every repair costs $99.95 and nothing more. Whether we spend 1 hour or 3 days, repairing your PC is always $99.95. I'm Joe Gillette. Visit Computer Repair and Services at 1441 Stillwater Boulevard or call us at 651-439-7544. It's just $99.95 for every PC repair, excluding hardware. At Computer Repair and Services, you can afford to fix your PC.
Boy, are we busy talking with David Schultz today, professor of, you name it, business, law, political science, the whole works, the whole McGilla over at Hamline University. David, thank you for being with us. You had mentioned a bit ago about the Vikings, the troubles they're having. Let's talk about the off-field troubles with respect to financing. Former Governor Arnie Carlson, along with Paul Ostro, I think Paul's on the Democratic side of the ledger.
Yes, correct.
And, of course, Arnie, a former Republican governor of the state. They're not at all happy with
financing. And a former state auditor.
Absolutely, that too. Just like Mark Dayton was a former state auditor.
Correct.
Can we make, here's an op-ed piece they wrote in the Star Trib, can we make lemonade out of a lemon? They're talking about the financing for Ziggy Wolf's Playhouse, the new Viking stadium. What do you make of it?
It's a debacle. The whole financing is a debacle. And remember, among other things here, is that the original deal was supposed to be for a electronic pull tabs to pay for the state share of the financing. That didn't work out, and it didn't work out for the dumbest. I'm just going to say it's dumb. What happened is that no one ever verified to check to see if, in fact, it was going to generate $35 million a year in revenue. Where did that figure come from? It came from the vendors themselves who said it was going to do that. And so that collapsed.
Yep.
The state had to come back then with a fix. And that fix, which was going to basically take some money from what was called an Amazon.com tax and a one-time tax in terms of, I think it was also like on some tobacco stuff.
Right.
Is a one-time fix that also is going to need to be fixed yet again, too. And so the fix of the fix has to occur. The state funding doesn't work. The other thing it was supposed to be with this whole spending, which people forget, is that we say, well, Ziggy Wolf's going to have to put in all this money. What we really know is by the time Ziggy Wolf gets all the subsidies from the NFL and so forth, he's putting in about $36 million to get a $1.1 billion stadium. At every stage in the process, Ziggy Wolf pulled the wool over our eyes in the state, and the funding just does not work, and we now look in terms of dollars and cents. It may eventually have to come out of general revenue to pay for this.
That's our tax dollars.
Yeah. And then you look at all the development supposed to occur in downtown Minneapolis. We've got all kinds of problems in terms of the funding for that, or in terms of the plans that are going on. I mean, I won't even go into all the details here. The upshot is that I think Governor Carlson was absolutely correct, is that we need a serious audit and a serious reexamination of that funding scheme and that whole project, because the taxpayers were just basically taken advantage, you know, by Ziggy Wolf.
I'm not sure the wool is still over the eyes. This piece by Carlson, things from people like you have told us what's really going on. Is it too late? Is the horse out of the barn? Can we rejigger the whole deal? It seems like a Herculean task to do.
I think it's impossible at this point to do it. I think the state has been taken to the cleaners, and that's an understatement. And even if we know that now, I don't think there's the political will there. I don't think either Dayton or the Democrats have the political will at next legislative session to come back and do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the stadium goes up and it's going to be financed the way the lawmakers said it. So. That's right.
And we're going to wonder down the line why the taxpayers got such a bad deal on it. And then we're going to look at when the NFL Super Bowl is here, in a couple years or whatever, to get that here, how we basically forego a whole bunch of local sales taxes and revenues to bring it here. And so all the rationale about how good of a deal this is for the state is gone. Mm-hmm. And even beyond the debacle on the taxes, and I've written about this, and we've talked about my book before, American Politics, Age of Ignorance. The research is so overwhelming that public subsidies for professional sports stadiums is just about the worst public investment we can make in our society in terms of economic development, job production, cost per job. If you want to make the argument, say it's good entertainment, fine. But I would say that now that you got stories all about Adrian Peterson, beating up his kid, this is not going to play well. And so I think this is a vulnerable issue for the state and for Dayton.
Let's talk about the U.S. Senate briefly, then we'll get to Obama. The National Senate looks like the GOP is in position, maybe, to take control. What do you think? They need what? They pick up six seats and they've got it.
They need to pick up six seats and they've got it. Right now, they have what most people are saying who are following this really closely is they probably have it. They probably have the U.S. Senate at this point. And if so, this is huge in terms of basically stopping whatever little Obama can do on his agenda, which is not very much at this point. It basically comes to an end at this point. The hope that the Democrats have is that a couple of their close races, such as Landrieu in Louisiana or Pryor in Arkansas or Hagan in North Carolina, actually go in a slightly different direction. And then the Democrats are still hoping, that they might actually pick up a couple of Republican seats. For example, I think it's Michelle Nunn, who is the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn.
Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Is actually running a very good race. And then I think, what's her name? Is it Allison Lundgren in Kentucky is within shooting range of Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And so if the Democrats can get a little bit of momentum there, they might be in good shape. Now, what's interesting about this election, and the reason why it's not impossible still for the Democrats to pull this off, unlike 4 years ago, where people say 4 years ago was clearly what they call a wave election. It was just momentum, almost like a wave, like a pushing for the Republicans in. This year, there seems to be no side that has any kind of sort of wave going for them. And it may very well be that the elections hinge on local issues and local candidates at this point. And
so Chip O'Neill was right.
Chip O'Neill, I think, is always right. All politics is local. And so if that's true, the Democrats may have a shot of still pulling it off.
Obama and this terrible mess in the Middle East. He's going to expand our bombing campaign to Syria now, already doing some in Iraq. What about this? He gave a national address the other night, and you're not hearing rave reviews. You're saying, okay, sounds okay. Even his own party is tepid in its response. What's going on here? You brought along an interesting book.
I brought along an interesting new book. Okay.
Go ahead and tell us how
Okay. I do a blog, and my most recent blog is by Why Obama, McCain's, and Others' Strategies for ISIS Are Going to Fail. Definitely going to fail.
That's not very subtle, is it?
No subtlety whatsoever. And I listened to the speech, and I am old enough to remember Vietnam. I am old enough to remember the lessons of Vietnam that our public officials haven't listened to. And when I heard about Obama saying, we're going to now do things like bomb Syria, I thought of Nixon and bombing Cambodia. I thought of ISIS as being like the Tet Offensive. I thought of us saying that we're going to have other people do the fighting, reminding me of when Nixon said his secret plan was the Vietnamization of troops. That is basically pulling out American troops and putting the Vietnamese in. But the most important thing that I heard in that speech the other night was this idea, basically thinking that we're going to somehow bomb ISIS into submission. And I have to read a passage from this small passage. It's the greatest book ever written on the Vietnam War. Francis Fitzgerald, who won a Pulitzer for it, a book called Fire in the Lake. Anybody who wants to know anything about Vietnam should read it. And if I could just sort of read a small passage here. And it was, let's see. The United States was not just fighting a border war or intervening as Imperial China so often did. It was entering into a moral and ideological struggle over the form of the state and the goals of society. Its success with its chosen contender would depend not merely on U.S. military power, but on the resources of both the United States and the Saigon government to solve the Vietnamese domestic problems in a manner acceptable to the Vietnamese. And what this book is famous for is saying is that what the United States never understood about Vietnam was two things. First, it was a battle for hearts and minds, and you can't bomb people into submission. But two, we thought Vietnam was this big global war about dominoes, about communism versus the free world, when in fact what it was really about was local issues and local conflict. And it's the same thing here. We said before, it's all politics is local, as Tip O'Neill said. What's going on with ISIS, with Iraq, with Syria, is all about local issues. And we somehow think it's have global consequences. We're going to fail. We're going to fail because we're going to bomb. We're going to bomb, and we're going to bomb, and we're never going to think about the hearts and minds and the local issues that are involved there.
There's a so-called new government in Baghdad, and the truth is, even under this new government, the Sunnis, supposedly under their tutelage, the Sunnis will not fight alongside the Shiites.
Right.
You can't get them on the same side, apparently. So even under this government, you can't get your own armed forces together.
Correct. You can't do that.
You've got the Kurds, and this is a country that was bludgeoned together after World War One by the Brits and the French in Syria at the point of a gun.
Right. These are all artificial.
These are three distinct and separate religious sects groups.
Right. They are artificial borders carved together in the waning days of the British Empire. One other thing I was going to say here. One of the things that was missing from his speech the other night in terms of the hearts and minds strategy is how do we dissuade people from wanting to join ISIS, Al-Shabaab, and Al-Qaeda? And the reason why that's important, Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, is a huge recruiting ground for some of these terrorist organizations. And until such time as we figure out a strategy that discourages people from wanting to fight as terrorists, same thing with Great Britain. The executioners for those two videos of Americans, it was a British person who was an ISIS person who did the dirty work and was doing the narration. Until such time as we figure out how to discourage that type of joining, we're never going to win this war. So at best, all Obama has done is push the problem onto the next president.
David, if you were the next president, how would you go about trying to solve this mess?
I'm glad I'm not the next president
because
I don't know how to do it. But it would have to be at this point more in terms of understanding the fact that we're going to have to figure out a way of empowering local groups to solve the problems themselves.
Yeah,
and exactly what that means, I don't know. Yeah. And it may be even at some point that we can't even do that. I don't know. This may be one of those issues that I'm not sure there's very much we can do at this point. The other problem I was going to say, the other problem over here too when I heard his speech is I have enormous respect for Colin Powell. Colin Powell enunciated back in the 90s what's called the Powell Doctrine that said before we commit U.S. military force, we should be thinking about what we're trying to accomplish, what our goals and objectives are, what's our benchmark for success, and what's our exit plan. We have none of that. Not just from Obama, by the way. I'm going to throw my rocks at everybody. Lindsey Graham, you know, who's a senator in South Carolina, and John McCain seem to think the solution for everything is send in the Marines. No matter what it is, send in the Marines. And they, too, don't have any way of answering those Colin Powell questions.
I believe Colin Powell famously said, if you break it, you own it.
And that's exactly what happened. We broke Iraq, we own it, and we're stuck with it.
You know, in a perverse kind of way, people look at Tito in Yugoslavia, the old Yugoslavia, look at Saddam Hussein in the old Iraq, and said these were despicable people, and they were, they're evil. But they held it together. They kept the lid on the pot.
Yes.
In their own terrible way, but at least it wasn't spreading. You didn't have Al-Qaeda, you didn't have this ISIS movement. It's amazing that you would say, well, we're not longing for the days of Tito and Saddam Hussein, but in a sense, it was a more controlled craziness over there.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, certainly no one's going to say that they had good records on human rights, but in terms of confining ethnic conflict, in terms of containing sort of this flame that's bursting out of its, you know, wherever it's going at this point, they would have kept it under control.
Let me ask you about Barack Obama. It's interesting and I think very telling that the opinion page, the op-ed page of the Minneapolis Tribune, which is, you know, well known for being left-leaning, a liberal page. I'm not talking about the news columns. That's not true. But on the op-ed page, it's always been a pro-Obama thing. In the last couple, three, 4 months, that page has really become very critical of Barack Obama. So when the Trib is starting editorially to kind of turn on the guy, that's pretty telling, isn't it?
It's pretty significant at this point. And I think a lot of the liberals who were very strongly supportive of Barack Obama are walking away disappointed at this point. Walking away disappointed in the sense that he failed on so many things that he promised. Now, partly he failed because of Republicans refusing to go along. But also, in some sense, and this has sort of been my impression for the last few months, I feel like he's sort of have given up his presidency. I mean, partly he's lame duck, but he just sort of seems that he's worn out. He's beaten up at this point. And now with him essentially continuing Bush's war, continuing Cheney's war over there, I think a lot of liberals are saying at this point he's just finally capitulated.
A real big gaffe from him not so long ago when asked if he had a strategy for ISIS. He said, I don't have one.
Yeah. I mean,
if you don't have one, you don't say that.
That's right. I was going to say, you could admire his eyes.
I have one, but I can't. Why would I want to say it?
Right. I was going to say, Nixon never had a strategy when he was running for president. He says, I got a secret plan for getting us out of the war. His secret plan was he never had a plan. And so, same thing with Obama. But you don't say it. You know, Obama could have said, I've got a strategy, but I can't tell anybody. I admire his honesty, but this is one of those situations where I tell my students in an ethics class, I say, is it okay to lie to the enemy to trick them?
Yes.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. You don't lie to the American public, but no. He could have lied to ISIS and said, I got a plan.
David Schultz, what are your students saying these days about world affairs, about ISIS, about the mess over there? Are they talking about it at all? Are they curious? Are they intellectually curious about what's going on and how we get out of that?
A little bit, but I will say this week, the biggest issue wasn't ISIS. It was Ray Rice.
Go on, tell us about that.
Ray Rice and the...
What are they saying about this? Tell the listener who this is.
Ray Rice is the person who was taped, knocking out his wife.
Elevator,
knocking out his wife.
Or the woman who became his wife. Correct,
like that. And this was the issue that really sort of dominated, sort of like, let's say, beginning of class, we kibitz for a little couple minutes and
what
talk about
this. What did say about it? What did they say?
Goodell's got to go.
Oh, the commissioner of the NFL.
Commissioner's got to go. That the NFL has no credibility now in terms
I think they had the video a long time ago.
Oh, they did.
They said they didn't.
They said, that's right. Goodell lied because he said we didn't have the video. In fact, they had the video for several months. Actually, even before we knew they had the video, at one point he said, well, we have no authority to get the video. It's called ASK.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Interesting to hear what's in the minds of the young people these days.
Yes.
Huh? Now, they may have a clearer picture than a lot of us do.
And hopefully they change the world better than we did.
It's going to be their world. Good luck with
that,
young ones. Okay, David Schultz, thank you so much for being with us. We'll get you back here on the music show shortly, too. Okay, how about that?
Perfect, good. You're welcome.
All right, thank you. David Schultz, professor at Hamline University. Stan Turner here. Kyle, thank you very much. Everybody, enjoy the weekend. It's a beaut out there. Take advantage of it. Put it in a bottle and take it out in January and February. You'll love it. Good weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday on the All Request Dedication Program at noon. Bye-bye.